Today on the Matt Walsh Show, the media has assembled the outrage mob once again, this time to hunt down and punish a frat boy who allegedly made racist noises while confronting a pro-Palestine protester at Ole Miss. Also, a new investigation reveals that the state of Massachusetts is paying $21 a plate to feed glorified dog food to illegal immigrants. The scandal isn't the quality of the food, but the fact that they're spending tax money to feed illegal immigrants in the first place. And Kristi Noem goes on Face the Nation to promote her new book. What follows is one of the most bizarre and awkward interviews any politician has ever given, and that's no exaggeration. We'll talk about all that and more today on The Matt Walsh Show. Can your savings weather another economic storm? Think about what you've put away for the future. Inflation can render cash worthless, and real estate can crash as it did in 2008. During times of economic uncertainty or market volatility, investors tend to flock to gold as a safe haven asset. Its value tends to increase during turbulent times, providing a buffer against market downturns. This is why people are flocking to gold now and why Birch Gold is busier than ever. Birch Gold understands that navigating financial decisions can be daunting. That's why their dedicated in-house IRA department is there to guide you every step of the way. Birch Gold is committed to addressing your questions and concerns promptly. Their team is always ready to provide answers and clarity, whether it's about fees, taxes and rollovers, or the timing of the process. They are here to ensure you feel valued and well-informed. Text Walsh to 989898 to talk to one of the Birch Gold's experts and claim your free info kit on gold. You'll learn how to convert an existing IRA or 401k into a tax-sheltered IRA in gold. The best part is, doesn't cost you a penny out of pocket. Just text Walsh to 989898. That's Walsh to 989898. As soon as the hobo encampments began popping up on university campuses all over the country, it was only natural to wonder how long these students could hold out before something else grabbed their attention. College kids aren't known for their commitment to anything necessarily, especially right before the beginning of summer vacation. And it was never clear exactly how stinking up a few random quads and holding out for humanitarian aid in the form of a Chipotle burrito bowl was ever going to affect what's happening in the Middle East anyway. Of course, the whole operation, as I've outlined previously, was never even about Gaza or Israel in any way. Instead, it's about repackaging anti-white hatred into yet another astroturfed national campaign of riots and civil disorder just in time for a presidential election. So at some point, it stood to reason, these kids would stop pretending to care about the war in Gaza altogether. They would drop the act and move on to something else. Well, over the weekend, as if on cue, that pivot took place. All at once on campuses and inside newsrooms all over the country, left-wing outrage over the Middle East subsided. And it was replaced with abject horror concerning a new, supposedly far greater crime against humanity. This act of pure, unadulterated evil took place, if you can believe it, on the campus of the University of Mississippi. And it was all recorded on video. Now, if there are children in the room right now, avert their eyes or even turn off this podcast because it's too much for them to see. If you have a sensitive stomach, turn away now. This is footage of the atrocity that was caught live on camera. Brace yourself. Okay, now, if you're anything like me, you probably missed the part of that footage that you're supposed to be angry about. In fact, you're probably watching, like a Where's Waldo? You're watching it, you're trying to spot where's the offensive thing. It's kind of hard to see. For such a supposedly earth-shattering event, you know, it's kind of tough to spot. Instead, what you see, or what you think you see, is a bunch of frat bros who probably aren't even that political. They're probably just tired of the narcissistic and highly fragrant leftists who have been defiling their campus. They're pro-America more than anything else. The American flag overalls are pretty big clue there. Beyond those overalls, which are fantastic, by the way, what's the big deal, you might ask? Well, leave it to the crack reporting team of the Mississippi Free Press to explain why exactly we should be outraged. As one of the paper's reporters put it, quote, "A white Ole Miss frat boy dances like a monkey and makes monkey noises near a black woman who was protesting for Palestine." Okay, so if you go back and you look at the tape and you focus entirely on the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see about 2 seconds of a student jumping up and down while flailing his arms and making a face. And we're supposed to conclude this student was dancing like a monkey and therefore was also insinuating that black people are like monkeys. And in turn, we're supposed to be extremely outraged by all this. Now, there are a lot of logical leaps here, which I'll get to in a second. The path from, you know, normal to outrage, if you want to get from one to the other, requires you to jump across like 5 different widely spaced lily pads. But first, it's important to understand that this was the unanimous reaction from the left. Even as a supposed genocide, quote unquote, is going on in the Middle East, this is what they decided to hyperventilate over. Jemele Hill got the lynch mob started. She wrote, quote, "What fraternity does he represent? The fraternity's national leadership needs to be contacted immediately, and that frat should be barred from campus." She wants the whole frat barred from campus, not just that one guy. CNN, NPR, Newsweek, the Associated Press, pretty much every other outlet published similar pieces with a similar tone about the supposedly racist confrontation. A former DNC field worker named Adam Parkomenko wrote that this incident is yet more proof that America is, quote, a racist country. The NAACP chapter at Ole Miss bemoaned the, quote, abhorrent but also entirely unacceptable and, quote, deeply disheartening behavior in the footage. The Guardian reported that some said that Mississippi's governor reminded them of a segregationist, quote unquote, because he put out a tweet praising the students in that video. So just to review that, he tweeted out that clip, probably didn't even notice the supposed monkey sounds, like I didn't, like a lot of people didn't the first time. And he said something positive about the students generally, and so therefore he is a segregationist. That's the, like I said, there's a lot of logical leaps going on here. The Daily Beast called the clip gross. Left-wing lobbyist Nina Turner wrote, quote, "This is a video showing anti-blackness." And Turner also scolded Congressman Mike Collins, who had praised the students in the video, quote, "Representative, that is a white man making monkey gestures at a black woman. And these protesters are not terrorists. Don't play games. Check yourself." Now, to be clear, it's not just commentators on the left who are saying things like this. Some conservative pundits joined in as well. Rob Smith, for example, wrote, "The Ole Miss incident was incredibly racist. I don't care what influencers say or post. I care what elected officials do. Representative Mike Collins is an absolute clown for posting what he posted. I said what I said. Cry more." I like when someone who's crying says to other people, cry more. Like, dude, you're the one crying over that video that is as innocuous as it gets. Former RNC chairman Michael Steele agreed, quote, "Representative Mike Collins, this is not taking care of business. And if you think it is, exactly what is the business you're referring to? Your casual approval of racist behavior and the need you seemingly feel to brag about it is an abject failure of your leadership as a member of the United States Congress and not a proud moment for you or Ole Miss." So this is, in short, yet another moment where several commentators on the right have joined in with the outraged mob on the left, which is something that never happens the other way around, of course. And in response to this outrage from all sides, the student's fraternity, Phi Delta Theta, has kicked him out. So they have already succumbed to the pressure. It happened pretty much immediately. Ole Miss has opened a student conduct investigation, which sounds ominous. And instead of everybody just ignoring this episode and moving on, because there's about 10 million more important things happening in the country right now, it's following the standard cancellation template from 2020. The student has been doxxed online. His picture's all over the place. He's being threatened. Organizations are cutting ties. You know the drill. The other familiar part of this story is that, once again, the mob is claiming that out-of-context video footage tells us everything we need to know about the particular incident. But as a basic factual matter, it's not even clear to me that this student was making monkey noises in the first place. Again, he's featured in the video for something like 1.2 seconds. I never noticed the quote-unquote monkey noises until everyone else pointed it out. And without that prompting, I'm not sure I ever would have interpreted it that way to begin with. And more to the point, you know, there's something funny and ironically racist about leftists always trying to connect monkey noises to black people? Like, it seems to me that if you see that and you think, well, he's making a monkey noise, he must be talking about a black person, then it seems like you're revealing something about yourself and your own perceptions more so than about this kid. But this is a recurring theme, and you have to wonder why that is. They did the same thing in late 2022 when somebody allegedly made monkey noises at a girls' high school volleyball game in Texas. You might remember that incident because we talked about it on the show, but you probably don't remember it because the narrative was embarrassing for everybody involved, and the media immediately dropped it. So just to refresh your memory, here's the allegedly racist footage, which was uploaded by a mother in the stands. I want you to watch and listen and see if you can detect the monkey noises here. Listen. Okay, so now if you, with the prompting ahead of time that listen for the monkey noises, you could probably hear something that's like, okay, well, maybe, I guess that's it. You can hear someone shrieking in the background. But without that prompting, I don't know where your mind has to be. Without that prompting at all, to listen to a video like that, and number one, think, oh, that's someone's definitely doing monkey noises. And then number two, think, well, they must be targeting it at black people. Like, to get from not just one, but to make it to two, again, you're saying something about your own perceptions, it would seem to me. Now, you'll notice that no one in the stands or on the court reacted in any way to these allegedly racist monkey noises. In fact, not even the players who were supposedly being targeted by these chants reacted. You can see, like, everyone's just sitting there. No one's even looking over to see what's going on. It was only after this woman got home and uploaded the footage saying that she heard a racist monkey chant that some sort of investigation was launched by the school district. Well, the story fizzled out, though, because if you listen to the footage, it's not remotely clear what the woman's really talking about or you know, who, what noises are being made or who they're being targeted at. People do all kinds of chants at sporting events. They make all kinds of noises for all kinds of different reasons. So for all we know, that's what's happening at Ole Miss. Maybe this frat kid saw a large, irate woman intentionally antagonizing him and all of his friends, and maybe he decided to jump up and down to yell and mock her, not because she's black, but because she's being annoying. And she's antagonizing them. It's even possible that he had no animus towards this woman whatsoever. After all, during the same interaction, the frat bros also referred to this large black protester as a Lizzo. And, you know, we're being told that that was also a racist comment. But that's interesting to me because previously we have been told, you know, relentlessly, in fact, that Lizzo is the paragon of female beauty. All women should aspire to look and act like Lizzo. So really, they were complimenting her, weren't they? I mean, if you think she's a beautiful woman, this is a compliment. So maybe in this instance, imitation is the most sincere form of flattery. Who knows? But here's the important point. Even if this student did what they accused him of doing, even if he was imitating this Lizzo lookalike in a disparaging way, then at worst, he's guilty of making an inappropriate joke. Now, you can call it racist or bigoted if you want. If it makes you feel more oppressed and that makes you feel good, that's fine. Doesn't really matter. Whatever you call it, this is not the sort of thing that a kid should have his life destroyed over. There are much worse sins than engaging in a mocking dance for 2 seconds, no matter how bigoted, quote unquote, that dance might allegedly be. And the response to this student should reflect that. In fact, at a public university like Ole Miss, it's also not clear that the school has any right to punish him at all. The First Amendment allows students at public universities to exercise their right to freedom of speech, which includes speech that many people find bigoted or offensive. And also, by the way, if you've been listening to the show for the last 2 weeks, you know that I have made that exact same argument about free speech applying to even speech that we find abhorrent. I have made that exact same argument to the pro-Palestine protesters, you know, in their favor as well. Now, there's been a lot, because there's actually been a lot of that kind of speech on college campuses in the last few weeks, if you haven't noticed. And most of it's coming from the other side. And there's no argument that this Ole Miss incident is somehow uniquely offensive and horrible, because pretty much every day college kids are caught on camera doing and saying things far worse than this. especially during these protests. And again, especially coming from the other side of the protests. The pro-Palestine protesters have said plenty of vile things. One activist held up a sign at Columbia saying Jewish students should be Hamas's next target, quote unquote. Somebody just yelled, kill the Jews at a rally at Northeastern University the other day. Now, it's not clear who exactly said that, but you'd think that there'd be some proportional amount of interest in answering that question. But there isn't really. And of course, there's systematic anti-white and anti-Asian bias at all of these schools in both admissions and hiring all the time. And that impacts a lot more lives than whatever this frat boy was doing for 2 seconds. So if we're going to destroy this one kid's life over this 2 second whatever he was doing, then we should, well, I guess, also expel all these protesters and fire every administrator in every one of these schools. And until we do that, then no one should even pretend to care about this one Ole Miss frat boy being bigoted or whatever. It's so disingenuous that it's actually nauseating. And this is a point that goes without saying, but, you know, I'll say it anyway. If this was a black student making racist statements and gestures at a white frat boy, none of these people would give a damn. You know, the outrage mob would either ignore it or outright defend it. And we have heard, and by the way, we have heard anti-white statements coming from the pro-Palestine protesters. There was someone on camera at one of these protests saying, we don't like white people here. We hate white people here, something like that, pretty explicitly. So there's, but you hardly remember it because there's no conversation about it. Nobody cares. And even more, we know this is the case because, you know, the outrage mob doesn't give a damn when white people are beaten to a pulp on camera. I mean, forget about mean things being said about them. For example, here's a story that precisely nobody on the left cares about. Remember the black guy in Brooklyn who sucker punched a 57-year-old white woman in the face, breaking her jaw? We talked about that. Well, he's a habitual offender who's done this several times. Here's that footage.
Tonight at Eyewitness News exclusive, and yet another unprovoked, violent attack in New York City, this time in Brooklyn. A vicious sucker punch out of nowhere yesterday to the face of a woman as she was just walking down the street in Crown Heights. Tonight, she's talking through her injuries to Eyewitness News reporter Sefon Kim.
It is a random, unprovoked, vicious attack on a 57-year-old woman in Brooklyn. Watch as the suspect ignores another man walking nearby, then punches the woman in her face, causing her to stumble backwards.
What happened? Why are you hitting me? Why are you hitting me? I was bleeding a lot. Mom, I'm so scared, I'm so afraid.
Dulce Pichardo was on the receiving end of that punch, her mouth now wired shut, her face fractured in several places, drinking food out of a straw for 6 weeks, permanent damage to her lower lip, 3 teeth knocked out, and she might need surgery. In this Eyewitness News exclusive, Pichardo says he didn't say a word, just stared at her, then broke her jaw.
He hit me very, very strong over here, and he broke everything here. Everything's broke.
So it's another random, unprovoked attack. They just assume that none of these videos of black people punching white people can possibly be racially motivated. They're all just random. You know, the frat kid's dance is immediately determined to be racist, but a black person going around punching white people is just acting randomly. Well, maybe the supposed monkey noises, if they were monkey noises, were also random. I mean, random things happen all the time, apparently. And anyway, that assault happened in March. What happened next? Well, in a rare move in New York, prosecutors upgraded this guy's charges to a felony. They also wanted to put him in jail before trial. But the judge overseeing this case, Brooklyn Supreme Court Justice Matthew Sciarrino, rejected the prosecutor's bail request. So he's back out on the street right now. They put that guy back on the street where he can punch more people. And if you have a problem with that, you should know that the judge doesn't care. He just retired to Florida. That's not an exaggeration. The judge has left the state. So he released this guy and just left the state. He's fled the hellhole of New York, which he has helped to turn into a hellhole for a state that actually enforces the law. Now, I'd give about a million more examples of anti-white violence that's not simply tolerated, but endorsed by the most powerful institutions in this country. None of it gets a fraction of the attention of one white student doing a dance for 2 seconds at Ole Miss. But I don't need to go through all these examples because it's not 2020 anymore. There's no excuse for anyone on the right to fail to recognize what's going on here. When one side is allowed to commit racial violence with impunity, while the lynch mob assembles to punish the other side for mockery and jokes, It's a pretty good big clue that nobody really cares about the mockery and jokes. It's all a power play. And unless conservatives want a beat-for-beat replay of 2020, which is clearly what the left wants at this point, then it's well past time we stop pretending otherwise. Now let's get to our five headlines. You know, there's nothing like sitting behind home plate at a baseball game, being courtside at a basketball game, or front row for your favorite concert. When you want the best, you have to act quickly, or someone else will instead. It's like if you're hiring for your business. You want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. So what's the best way to do that? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/Walsh. Once you review ZipRecruiter's list of the most qualified candidates for your job, you can easily invite your top choices to apply to encourage them to apply sooner. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best talent fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/Walsh and try it for free. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/Walsh. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. We start with a CBS News investigation in Massachusetts where taxpayers have so far forked over $1 billion to feed and house illegal immigrants and homeless people, and mostly homeless illegal immigrants. And it turns out, shockingly, that this money is being used in a very inefficient way. I don't know if you can believe that. It's, like I said, it's shocking. Have you ever heard of such a thing? That the government is spending millions of dollars on something and doing it in the least efficient, most expensive, least effective way possible. It's making sure, as it always does, that it gets the least bang for its buck that it possibly can, or rather bang for our buck that it possibly can. Totally unprecedented. Anyway, here's the report. Listen.
The I-team was first to uncover a $10 million no-bid contract for a catering company and the hotel groups collecting millions for housing and food contracts.
WBZ Chief Investigator Cheryl Fiandaca has been digging into those contracts and discovered there appears to be little to no state oversight of the vendors who are collecting tens of millions in taxpayer money.
Honestly, there's nothing edible.
Here are some of the dinners that taxpayers paid $21 for. Spaghetti with hot dogs and rice with one chicken drumstick.
The spaghetti with the hot dog in it. Really? We're paying $21 for that. Okay. It's crazy.
These lunches and dinners were given to migrants and homeless families at the Fairfield Inn, Dedham, Boston. The contract obtained by the I-team shows the state is paying this one hotel $7,343,316 for food, with no provision or requirement that the meals be nutritious or meet USDA recommendations, leaving it up to the hotel to decide what to serve.
When you hire a vendor like that, you need guidelines. So you really, really should have some oversight of the quality of the meals that are being served.
But the contract does not have any oversight provisions for the food, nor does it give the state the right to inspect the meals, meaning the state is paying vendors millions without knowing what it's getting for its money.
I don't think that we could have really foreseen just how horribly this is being managed. When you look at those meals and when you look at the cost of the hotels, it doesn't take a lot of negotiation to make these contracts better.
The Fairfield Inn is part of Geary Hotel Management. 9 of its hotels have state contracts, and by the end of the year, will collect $24,319,212 for the meals it's providing.
Okay. Now, first of all, spaghetti and hot dogs might sound kind of gross, but I will say that that does remind me of how I ate when I was completely broke and living alone from the ages of 20 to 25. In fact, that meal for me would be sort of a splurge, because usually, like, I'd eat just spaghetti or just a hot dog because those were cheap foods and easy to make. But if I was really feeling fancy, then I would combine them. And another combination that I loved was, well, not loved, but that I endured, would be, you have instant mashed potatoes and a hot dog. So there's a two, because you would get a box of instant mashed potatoes, you get a hot dog, and you put gravy on the whole thing. Don't knock it till you try it. Anyway, the point here is that the meal isn't bad. And just to be clear here, the problem is not the type of meal. Like, this is the issue that, of course, the CBS, the local CBS affiliate in Boston has. This is the problem they have. To them, this is why it's a scandal, is because the meal, the quality of the meal for these poor, unhoused migrants is not up to snuff. And so for them, that's the problem. And the woman that was that they interviewed was a nutrition professor. So they brought in a professor, an academic, because he needed an expert to tell us that a hot dog and spaghetti isn't the most nutritional meal. It's also not the least nutritional meal either. I mean, you could do a lot worse. But that's not really the scandal. It's not that they failed to get FDA approval or whatever. It's not that there's not enough nutritional value. The problem is threefold. Number one, the Massachusetts state government has somehow found a way to spend $21 on a hot dog and spaghetti. Now, I know that inflation is bad right now, but it should not cost you 21 bucks for that meal. Because even with inflation, okay, a pack of hot dogs is still like $5 or $6. Box of spaghetti is $2 or $3, even with inflation. So even on like the higher end, if you're buying like high quality hot dogs and higher quality boxes of spaghetti, you know, for $10, you should be able to make like 10 plates of gourmet spaghetti and hot dogs. Should run you like $1 or $2 a plate. And they're spending 20 times that per plate. That's what they're doing. And that's problem number one. Problem number two, of course, is that taxpayers are footing the bill. And problem number three, which is actually problem number one, this is the primary problem, is that this is all being done for criminal aliens who are in this country illegally and shouldn't be here in the first place. Okay, this is not a problem that we should have to solve. Feeding these people should not be the issue. And I'm also not interested in hearing, you know, there was that committee hearing in New York on the migrant crisis, and we played the clips a couple weeks ago, where you had, in this case, it was mostly migrants from Africa who were called in and were complaining about, I don't know if it was spaghetti and hot dogs, but it was meals that they found to be similarly unappealing. And they were complaining about the quality of the meal. Well, I'm not really interested in hearing your complaint because you shouldn't be here in the first place if you're an illegal immigrant. Now, you know how I feel about the illegal immigration crisis. You know that I want the border to be shut down. It is disgusting and an outrage that we are allowing immigrants to come here illegally and take our resources, take it from us and our families while actual Americans are suffering. So you know where I stand in all that. So rather than repeating those arguments, I think it's worthwhile to highlight another fact that this story makes clear, which is that even if we all agreed that it was morally right and ideal, and even a moral obligation for the United States to act as a global homeless shelter. Now, I certainly do not agree with that. I think most of the people watching this show don't agree with that. But, you know, that's the argument that's made from the other side, that this is our obligation, that we are, for whatever reason, we are obligated. Just because we happen to live here in America, it is our obligation to feed and house anyone who happens to come here. We have to be prepared to feed and house the entire world. Now, the interesting thing is the people that say that will also be quick to mention that, you know, America is not in any way superior to anybody else. You know, American exceptionalism is a bigoted concept, they'll tell us. So we're not superior, we're not exceptional, there's nothing special about us. In fact, not only that, but we're worse than everybody. We are like, we're moral cretins compared to the rest of the world, they'll tell us. But then at the same time, we have a special obligation to take care of everybody and you know, no other country has it. So it doesn't really make a lot of sense. But let's just say, for the sake of argument, that we were to agree with that. We say, you know what, it's our moral obligation. We should feed and house everybody. Invite all 8 billion. We can fit 8 billion people here. Like technically we can. Technically. Putting aside issues of resources and everything, technically we could fit the entire population of the planet into America. Maybe we should. Maybe it's our obligation. Well, if you accept that insane argument, you're still left with the problem, with the practical problem. You're left with the issue on practical grounds that our government is obviously not capable of playing this role, of playing the role of global homeless shelter. We can't. I'm not sure that any government could do it. Certainly, there's no government that could feed and house the entire world, but we certainly can't. I mean, they're spending $21 on a plate of spaghetti and a hot dog. So they've found a way to make the cheapest possible meal expensive. Like, I'd hate to see what would happen if they started serving, I don't know, bologna sandwiches, bologna and cheese sandwiches. It'd be like $95 a plate. Bologna, white bread, American cheese, maybe some baby carrots on the side. That's a $95 plate at the 4-star Uncle Sam restaurant. So we don't even, you hardly need to get into the moral argument at all. Again, as insane and deranged as the moral argument is from the left, it's like, this doesn't work. We can't do this. It's just not, it's let some other government try it. We obviously can't. We're over here paying $21 per plate for spaghetti and a hot dog. That's what we're doing. All right. Here's a clip that is circulating online right now, though it's actually from a few months ago. This is RFK Jr. doing a town hall with Patrick Bet-David, his podcast. And he's asked about the issue of gender transitions for minors. And here's what he says.
What will you do as a president to get this nonsense out, to prevent kids under the age of 18, with or without the consent of the father, to transition? You may even say that is an okay policy you're a part of that many families disagree with. One, what's your position on this, and what will you do as a president?
I mean, my position is that people should not be able to have access to those procedures, that minors shouldn't, without parental permission. And, you know, I don't know enough about it, Patrick, to say that it should be completely illegal for
under 18?
No, but yeah, I just don't know enough.
Okay, so he says he doesn't know enough. And like I said, this is from a couple of months ago, but it's getting attention now for whatever reason. It's circulating. I didn't see it until now, or at least I don't remember. I don't recall seeing it if I did. And I will say that RFK Jr.'s defenders have pointed out that this is a short clip from a longer conversation on the topic. And they've said that this is out of context. And that is a problem. It can be a problem of out-of-context clips. We just talked about it to open the show. It's circulating online all the time. And people assume that they know everything they need to know based on, you know, in this case, a 45-second clip or a 2-second clip even. So that can be a problem. But in this case, actually, it's not. Like, this is not out of context. There's nothing misleading about this clip. This is his position as he stated it. And if you watch the longer conversation where they talk about this for 7 or 8 minutes, it's just more of that. It's more of that. It doesn't really flesh out. There's not, out of context would be if he said this, and then if a minute later he said something that completely changes our perception of what we saw in that 45-second clip. But there is nothing. It's just he kind of circles around and around the point that he makes in that clip here where he says he doesn't really know enough about it and he isn't an expert and so on and so on. And I have to say that I really find this kind of triangulation to be more detestable than actually just coming out explicitly in favor of child gender transitions. Like, somehow I find the position that he takes and that we often hear from the so-called reasonable liberals, which RFK Jr. is supposed to be one of them. But I find that this kind of middle ground, like, I'd almost prefer if you just take, defend the indefensible. Come out and try to defend the indefensible rather than trying to find this middle ground approach. If you're going to defend the evil thing, then just defend it. It seems even more deranged to try to, I can see from both sides. It's like if we were debating, we were debating whether it's good to be a serial killer. And most, of course, most people are going to say, no, I think being a serial killer is bad. Serial killing is a bad thing. But then you have a few actual serial killers who say, you know what, actually, I think it's good. I'll tell you why I think it's good. And that's really demented. But then if you had some people in the middle who were like, well, I think we need more information on this topic. Before we can determine, you got the anti-serial killer saying one thing, pro on the, and I could, we could both have good points. I think I need to do more. I don't have enough information. I need to do more research on serial killing before I decide how I feel about it. Somehow that to me seems like the craziest of the three possible positions that you could take. There are some things that you should just know. You know, there are some conclusions you should be able to simply just draw without doing any research, actually. Like, there are some things that don't take any research to figure out. And I know there are plenty of times when doing research is a good thing, plenty of issues that there are issues where you really shouldn't say anything about them at all until you've done some research, because it requires research to understand. I mean, any issue involving foreign policy, for example, or most issues involving foreign policy require research, because now you're dealing with countries and geopolitics and oftentimes disputes that go back years and decades and centuries. And so it requires some base of knowledge. It does require some research before you can, take a firm position on it. And there are plenty, we do have a problem with plenty of people taking positions on things without doing any research whatsoever. But there are times when we need to do more research, where that can be, that's a cop-out. Because there are things you don't need to research. And one of them is the question of, is it okay to chemically castrate children? That's just not something you need to research. We don't need to do any research on it. The very first time that I discovered that this was a thing that was happening, whenever that was, years ago, first time I ever encountered this concept, I immediately knew, well, no, that's terrible. That's obviously an awful thing. We should not do that. There's literally no context that could ever make that okay. And just so happens that I have done plenty of reading on these issues ever since then. And well, what do you know? Everything that you read only makes what is obvious. Well, it can't be any more obvious, but it only underscores what should already be obvious to everybody. And so again, this is one of those things. And it goes to show, it's like, if you cannot, I know that RFK Jr. and he has been, he's contradicted the left on a few issues, like vaccines, of course, is the main one. And it's really starting to seem like that's really the only one. Because on every other issue that we've heard him talk about over the last several months, he basically just gives you, he either gives you the full-on radical left playbook on it, or he gives you something like this, where it's like, it is taking the left side, but trying to do it in a way that seems less committal, but it's still a leftist position. And so, yeah, he's that one thing where he had the guts to contradict the left, that's fine. But if you can't get this issue right, either because you really are confused about it somehow, or you're too cowardly to come out and say what you know to be true, either one, and I'm not sure which is worse. Probably the cowardly thing is where being cowardly is usually the worse than the alternative. But whichever is the case, if you cannot and do not come out explicitly and firmly on an issue like this, then it's just, you've totally discredited yourself intellectually and morally. And all of your opinions on every other topic have now become irrelevant and worthless. You know, it's one of those kinds of issues. All right, now for your dose of cringe today, although we've already seen plenty of it. It is a heavy dose, I'm warning you. This is a viral video posted by the Twitter account End Wokeness. Not made by that account, but reposted to Twitter by it. This video was made by students at Harvard Medical School. And here it is.
Looking at my notes, but my knowledge ain't fleeting. Spaced repetition, give me something to believe in. Passed all my tests, but I just skimmed the reading. In the food chain, we're the ones that eat it. Harvard Med ain't no bottom feeder. MD stands for my demeanor. Ask permission before I ever greet you. Does it radiate? Does it come with strain? Scale 1 to 10, can you rate the pain? When I knock the door, you ask, who is it? You can check my coat, it'll spell my name. Ah.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, you're messing with some Harvard MDs. Found my best friends for life from this Harvard MD. Giving everything we got for this Harvard MD.
Now from the top, make it drop, come get your Harvard MD. You got your offer, now say yes to this Harvard MD. We're talking doc, 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 that's a Harvard MD. You deserve the spot you got, future Harvard MD.
There's some docs in this house. There's some docs in this house. There's some docs in this house.
So there it is. Played a whole minute of it for you. I thought you would, probably 15 seconds would have been enough. 5 seconds. I mean, not playing it at all. It would have probably been, you would have preferred that. 10, 15 seconds would have gotten the point. Decided to go the whole minute for your own good, for your own betterment. It's a character building exercise, like my dad always told me. You know, it's a good way to, if you have to do something you don't want to do, builds character. Now, if you're listening only to the audio podcast, then you could hear the song, and maybe in a certain way, you experience the cringe in an even more sort of direct, concentrated form. But what you didn't see is not only you missed the dancing, sad to say for you, but you also didn't see how many people were involved in this thing. Like this was, there were 50 Harvard MDs who got together on 4 or 5 different locations across campus to make the worst music video of all time. And can I just say this, and I know I tend to harp on this point anytime we play bad poetry or bad music, which we so often do on the show, but can you at least rhyme? Look, you can't rap, you can't sing, you can't dance. Fine. I'm not going to blame you for that. But can you at least rhyme? Can you make the lines rhyme? You're Harvard MDs. You can't figure out how to write lines that rhyme, at least? You're messing with some Harvard MDs. Found my best friends for life as a Harvard MD. Giving everything I got to be a Harvard MD or whatever. That doesn't rhyme. You cannot rhyme Harvard MD with Harvard MD. And also, by the way, you can't put best friends for life. That phrase cannot appear in a rap song. You cannot. It's like there are laws against that, or there should be. But that's really a minor concern in the grand scheme of things, I suppose. Actually, it's not minor. I think people making rap songs and poetry that doesn't rhyme has become, it's a real epidemic in this country. It really upsets me a lot. Still, the bigger issue is just the total collapse of professionalism everywhere in the country, especially in the medical field, which is the place where you might argue we need it the most. Like 30 or 40 years ago, you would not have been able to find any Harvard MDs or MDs anywhere else that would participate in something like this. They would just never do it. And why wouldn't they do it? Just because, like, it's not, you don't do that. There's a certain dignity to being, or there should be, to being in the medical profession. You're supposed to be a very educated person. There's a kind of dignity to that, and you wouldn't be caught dead participating in something like this. Not because you can't have fun or anything like that, but just like you wouldn't, especially not in the, you know, with the white coats, and I don't know whether they're wearing masks the whole time, but like they're in professional attire doing this. And I think not all that long ago, you would not have been able to find any doctor who would participate in that. And now it's hard to find a doctor who won't do something like this. I mean, it's like every hospital and medical school in the country is just churning out music videos and dance videos and everything constantly. And I think that is not exactly a positive development. And now a very special message from our old friend, Adam Carolla.
Catch the series premiere of Mr. Burcham this Sunday, 9 o'clock, 8 Central, exclusively on Daily Wire Plus. Episode 1 is streaming for free, so no excuses, people. Mr. Burcham is decades in the making, and now it's showtime. Check out the Mr. Burcham trailer and see what the fuss is all about.
Just tell me what you need.
Jumping in the first one.
Rolling, speed, action.
Sawbuck's looking a little chubby wubby.
So I bought him some new food.
It's organic and vegan.
Dogs are supposed to eat meat. They're descendants of wolves. You ever see a vegan wolf on the Nature Channel?
I'm a vegan.
Coffee is for closers, ladies. Listen up!
Hey, don't make this a prison hug.
I'm a heteronormative, cisgendered white male.
For which I apologize.
I'm black, and that used to be enough, but I'm also bilingual, and I'm non-binary.
We're the Army! We drink more before 9 a.m. than you Navy pukes do all day.
He rubbed all the fur off his emotional support ferret. The damn thing looked like a four-legged penis.
Charity and work. Two words that should never go together. Like women and opinions.
I want a burly man. They're salty and make me dizzy.
Sorry, just need to find a thingy to fix my gaming chair.
When I was on the construction site, my chair was a 5-gallon bucket. It was also my toilet.
Hey, I'm done. I'm going back to bed. Thanks a lot.
Remember, Mr. Burcham's series premiere this Sunday, 9 o'clock, 8 Central. Stream it free only on Daily Wire Plus.
Now let's get to our daily cancellation. Well, last week we endured one of the silliest outrage cycles in recent memory when the media and the internet mob came together to scream at South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem for killing a dog 20 years ago. And as we discussed, the anger was absurdly overblown and incredibly stupid, but Noem was even stupider for bringing the dog killing story up in the first place. And she included the anecdote in her forthcoming book titled No Going Back, scheduled to be released, I believe, tomorrow. And the book is obviously meant to increase her national political profile and boost her unofficial campaign for vice president. Instead, as any story about killing a dog is destined to do in our culture, it torpedoed her vice presidential aspirations and her political career along with it. This book was supposed to be her ticket to the White House, but now she'll have to settle for being a part-time Fox News contributor, which, you know, is where her career would have ultimately ended up even if she became vice president. So you might say this just gets her to the ultimate destination much more efficiently and quickly. But in any event, it turns out that the story of her poor deceased dog is not the only strange detail that she, or more precisely her ghostwriter, included in the book. And on Sunday, she appeared on Face the Nation to talk about the book, and conversation went from weird to weirder very quickly. Watch.
So you write about lessons learned in leadership, and you bring up some specific incidents I want to ask you about. You talk about meeting some world leaders and one specific one. Quote, I remember when I met with North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un. I'm sure he underestimated me, having no clue about my experience staring down little tyrants. I've been a children's pastor after all. Did you meet Kim Jong-un?
Well, you know, as soon as this was brought to my attention, I certainly made some changes and looked at this passage. And I've met with many, many world leaders. I've traveled around the world. As soon as it was brought to my attention, we went forward and have made some edits. So I'm glad that this book is being released in a couple of days and that those edits will be in place and that people will have the updated version.
So you did not meet with Kim Jong-un. That's what you're saying.
No, I met with many, many world leaders. Many world leaders. I've traveled around the world. I think I've talked extensively in this book about my time serving in Congress, my time as governor, before governor, some of the travels that I've had. I'm not going to talk about my specific meetings with world leaders. I'm just not going to do that. This anecdote shouldn't have been in the book, and as soon as it was brought to my attention, I made sure that that was adjusted. So the book is not released until Tuesday, and so we're doing all that we can.
So she says that she's not going to talk about any specific meeting with world leaders, except that in her book, the one that she's there to promote, she does talk about a specific meeting, one with Kim Jong-un. The problem is that Any vaguely aware person will know that the communist dictator of North Korea probably isn't holding any meetings with the governor of South Dakota. Because why? And Noam is asked whether that meeting actually happened, and all she will say is that it was brought to her attention, and so it will be changed in the book. Well, what was brought to her attention? Did somebody bring to her attention the fact that she never actually met the leader of North Korea, or did someone bring to her attention the fact that this claim was made in her book? And if the former, then how could she have not known that she didn't actually meet the leader of North Korea? And if the latter, how could she have not known that this claim was made in her book? And obviously, the book was ghostwritten. No great scandal there. But did she really not even read her own book? Well, we know she read it because she's the narrator on the audiobook. So we're left with two possibilities. Either she knowingly lied about meeting Kim Jong-un and just assumed that nobody would call her on it, or she thought she met him only to find out later that she didn't. Well, how could that mistake be made? The interviewer probes that question to find out how, you know, how could you mix this up, but really doesn't get anywhere on that. It all adds up to, as we can see, the most awkward, cringiest kickoff to a book tour that we've probably ever witnessed. And it's not over. This exchange about North Korea and the question of whether Noam has ever actually met Kim Jong-un or been to North Korea, or whether she knows where North Korea is or what it is, continues, all while Noam refuses to admit that any mistake was made, even though she says that the thing she won't admit is a mistake is being changed nonetheless before it's released. Watch.
Mm-hmm. And I'm taking responsibility for the change that we've made.
And for the mistake in the book.
And I've told you that, and I'm... no, it's not. What I've said is that I have
decided...
You're
not taking responsibility for the mistakes
anecdote
in the book.
I've decided this, and I'm saying that this book is very, very good, and I've met with many world leaders, and that there are world leaders that I've met with that are in this book. There are many that I've met with that are not in this book.
Okay.
And this is an anecdote that I asked to have removed because I think it's appropriate at this point in time. But I'm not going to talk to you about those personal meetings that I've had with world leaders.
Okay.
I'm just not going to have that conversation because I think it's important.
What? Wait, what? I'm not going to have that conversation because I think it's important. But wouldn't you want to have the conversation if it's important? And again, if you don't want to talk about personal meetings, why is it in your book? She actually said the book is very... So, Governor, did you lie about what's in the book? Well, the book is very, very good. It's a very, very good book. First of all, the book is very, very good. So translation, I didn't write my book or read it until I did the audiobook, but I was tuning myself out for most of that. And if I did notice any problems, I figured it was too late to bring it up. And I just hoped that nobody else would notice, which is a safe bet because, as everybody knows, Republican politicians, especially ones that are associated with or hope to be associated with Donald Trump, rarely encounter any scrutiny at all. So, you know, of course, like, why couldn't you get away with just flagrantly making up events in your book? This brought us finally to the infamous story of poor Cricket. And here's how that exchange went. Watch.
I want to ask you again about the book. I know you know this question is coming because there's been such an enormous backlash about your revelation that you shot and killed a wire hair pointer named Cricket, who was 14 months old. You say in the book she came from another family that struggled with her aggression. You'd been training her to hunt. She got too excited, ruined the hunt, and then attacked and killed some chickens. I wonder if you have regrets about sharing this story.
You know, Margaret, this book is filled with vulnerable, painful moments in my life, filled with times where I've made very difficult decisions. The reason that this story is in the book, because people need to understand who I am and some of those difficult decisions. This was a dangerous animal that was killing livestock and attacking people. And I had little children at the time. Our operation had many kids running around and people in interaction with the public. And I made a difficult choice. I think you're a mother, too, and you have little kiddos. Would you make a choice between your children or a dangerous animal? And I think I would ask everybody in the country to put themselves in that situation, because that's what I faced. And I talk about it because what I'm tired of in this country is politicians who pretend to be something that they're not, that they aren't willing to have the hard conversations and look at the past and the tough decisions that they've made. What I talk about in the book extensively, when people are able to get it on Tuesday, is to see the whole story and the truth, not the spin that the media has put on this story. The media has put some or removed most of the facts, and what the reason this is in there is because I want people to know that I don't ask anybody else to take on my responsibilities.
I don't ask anybody else to take on my responsibilities. When there's a dog to kill, I do it myself. And I like it. Damn it, I like it. I actually would have respected her more if she had just said that. Like, if she had just said, look, I wanted to kill a dog, so I killed it. I kill animals all the time. What are you going to do about it? Like, I would have, I'll be alone in this, but I personally would have respected that a little bit more. It'd still be pretty weird. But although now, given the made-up Kim Jong-un story, I'm seriously starting to wonder whether Cricket even existed. It's possible that she never killed any dog, and her ghostwriter made that up too. And maybe Noam didn't want to admit that it was made up, so she just went with it. That's at least a possibility we have to consider at this point. And that's not the only animal execution recounted in her memoir. Soon the conversation turned to the goat that also crossed Kristi Noem and didn't live to tell about it. Listen to the details on this one.
In a part of a chapter called Bad Day to Be a Goat, and then after you shot the dog, you, quote, realized another unpleasant job needed to be done. Walking back up to the yard, I spotted our billy goat. You said he smelled and would chase kids, so you took him to the gravel pit and shot him twice. How do you justify that? How was the goat a threat? And I'm asking you this because it seems like you're celebrating the killing of the animals.
Not at all. This has been a story that my political opponents have tried to use against me for years. It's well known in South Dakota, and it has been to other people. And I want the truth to be out there and to understand that these animals were attacking my children, that we live on a farm and a ranch, and that tough decisions are made many times. And it is to protect people. And I'll tell you, the extremism of other people and how they have attacked me politically, I understand it. They're doing the same thing to me that they do to Donald Trump every day.
First of all, don't bring Donald Trump into this. He's got enough issues. You don't need to rope him in. But I'm sorry. Let's just back up for a moment. So she killed the goat on the same day that she killed the dog. I don't think we knew that, or at least I didn't. She was hyped up on adrenaline, filled with bloodlust, looking for something else to kill, and she happened to see that punk-ass goat hanging out by the barn and just decided then to take him to the same gravel pit that, at this point, I guess, was covered in blood and just busted two caps in his ass. And this is a story that a politician has decided to tell in her memoir, and she recounts it in a chapter titled Bad Day to Be a Goat. Now and also, by the way, the fact that this, according to her, this is like a well-known political controversy in South Dakota going back years. Like they've been debating the smelly goat that Kristi Noem killed for years now. I don't know if that's true or not. I don't know if people in South Dakota, when they heard this story, like, oh yeah, so there's the story about the goat again. I'm not sure if it's that well known, but that's pretty great if it is. I'm starting to get the impression that this whole book is just her bragging about killing various animals, interspersed with imaginary, fictionalized retellings of meetings with world leaders that never actually happened. So the whole book is like it's like a murderous, blood-soaked fever dream. I'm intrigued. I want to buy a copy of the book now. Honest to God, it sounds entertaining at the very least. And we haven't even made it to the best part yet. Listen to this.
But on this point, though, because you have been rumored to be a potential vice presidential candidate, as you know, and former House Speaker Newt Gingrich said killing the dog and then writing about it ended any possibility of her being picked as VP. You talk multiple times about it. In fact, at the end of the book, you say the very first thing you would do if you got to the White House that was different from Joe Biden is you'd make sure Joe Biden's dog was nowhere on the grounds. Commander, say hello to Cricket. Are you doing this to try to look tough? Do you still think that you have a shot at being a VP?
Well, number one, Joe Biden's dog has attacked 24 Secret Service people. So how many people is enough people to be attacked and dangerously hurt before you make a decision on a dog and
what
to do with
it? Well, he's not living at the White House.
That's the question that the president should be held accountable to.
Commander, say hello to Cricket. This is apparently not a joke. She really ends the book by threatening to kill Joe Biden's dog. I'm officially sold. I'll be pre-ordering my copy as soon as this show is over. And also, I like, by the way, that this interview was just nothing but the interviewer bringing up one animal after another and asking for her to justify why she killed it. Will kill it in the future. And she engages each time. You know, she's like, well, that goat smelled like garbage and it was annoying my kids. What do you want me to do? Now, granted, when I say that I want to read this book, it's because the book, it would seem, is a completely insane train wreck. And that might help her sell copies, but it represents an act of political suicide. I mean, this is something so close to actual self-immolation that watching that interview, I almost expected her to shout, "Free Palestine." She has destroyed herself completely in the most unnecessary, egregious, and hilarious way that we've ever seen. And she's done all that in an effort to promote herself. Many such cases, especially in politics. But that is why Kristi Noem is, not by me, but by her own choosing, today canceled. That'll do it for the show today. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. Have a great day. Godspeed.